Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of our service tonight, we have the privilege of having Paul and his family. They're going to first come and share with us about their recent trip to Cuba and what God is doing there. And then following that, our pastor is going to come and share with us from the book of Revelation. So, Paul?
You asked me how much time I needed. I said I'd spend the first hour talking about the politics of Cuba. And then, today I was just thinking about, as a little kid growing up at Westside Baptist Church, and Linda would probably know this name, Betty Ewing was a missionary to Nigeria, and she would come back. Her family was in that area, and getting excited as a kid about, that night was going to be missionary night, because she'd have slides of exotic places, and you get to hear stories, and I wouldn't hear that same preacher preach again. It'd be a little different. It just amazes me that little kid is, sharing about missions. Probably not as amazed as my former Sunday school teachers and RA leader and everybody else would be, but, it is a blessing. And, what a blessing it was for Caleb and Corey to get to go with me. It didn't really work out the way we wanted to. Originally, we were going to be taking a baseball team down to Cuba, and actually playing. And so they were going to get to go and play. It was the week after a story came out about one of the Cuban players and how he defected off the island. The government said you can't bring a team in. And they were convinced the whole time that we were there to spirit players off the island. And speaking to the guy from the convention who sort of was the liaison with the government, I pointed out the fact that if I was a Major League Baseball team or an agent with millions and millions of dollars potentially to throw at a ball player, I would pick something besides two old white guys who can't speak Spanish to go down to Cuba and try to find them. But he said that when you're not legitimate, you see ghosts everywhere. And he said the government sees ghosts everywhere. There's always something going on. But, and thinking about that and Caleb and Corey going and everything else, if we want the next generations to think missions are important, then we need to show them that this generation thinks it's important. And, want to say thank you to the church. You're a huge part of this. Corey and I, you helped support us going. And then a lot of you, I know, we're praying, and some of you supported individually. But also, the way we got around on the island was in a van that, a very nice van, air-conditioned van, which is really nice July in Cuba. That was purchased by Lottie Moon Funds, and the convention, the Southern Baptist Convention of Cuba, got it that way. As eternal pastime is a mission of this church, and many of you have given stuff over the years, and we get to store our stuff over in the bus barn, and Dave Veens goes to garage sales and brings me ball gloves and stuff like that. And I was really glad to see Steve Scott back there. Steve brought me a lot of umpire equipment this time around. It's really ironic, or not ironic, it's just the way the Lord works. I had never thought about getting umpire equipment. We've got all sorts of other equipment. And, Lord just kind of said, they have this Christian league that you're supporting. They've got to have umpires. They are a necessary evil. And, so he said, you ought to try to get some umpire equipment together. And I got in contact with a couple of my, umpiring guys I know, and they started gathering equipment, and Steve brought stuff in. And, I tell you, it was a big hit down there. It really was. And, we had just loaded, and shipped out of here. It was already gone. We FedExed a bunch of stuff to Florida, and then we picked it up they delivered it to the airport. And we had just shipped it out that day, and it hadn't been, within an hour or so of it being dropped off, that the guy that we worked with got a hold of me and said, hey, we got a request for what? Umpire equipment. All right, but anyway, you're a big part of this, and I really appreciate everything that you've done. There's a letter out on the mission table from the guy who runs the baseball league, thanking Hillcrest for what we've done and how it's helped them. So anyway, in 1959 is when the communists took over in Cuba, and it was the third wealthiest country in North America. And now, you know, their slogan is "Hooray for Haiti." I mean, if you get out of the tourist bubble, you know, it's just they really just don't have anything. They are hardworking people, but they're the government system. They just don't have the materials to work with that we would. Of course, they didn't trust the church, so they closed them down. They began arresting people. A lot of the seminary students were thrown in prison. We got to meet some of the pastors in different times we've been there that, you know, either they went or their pastor ended up in prison during this time, mostly because of international pressure. The Cuban Constitution was changed in 91 to stop religious discrimination. They basically just ran up the white flag because they were losing. And so anyway, there's still a residue of that, but the church is able to operate openly. We went out on a religious visa, you know, so there is a degree of religious freedom. It's better than what a lot of people think. Most people, how do you ever get there and all that? And, you know, it is open for people coming in. Our State Department has to sign off on the religious visa. Pastor David had to write a letter saying we'd be down there doing religious work, and you have to get all that on file, and their State Department has to agree. But anyway, in 91 when it changed, things changed in Cuba. And now they have churches all over, a lot of house churches. And their goal is to have a church within walking distance of every Cuban. And I know I've mentioned that in here at church before. Their definition of walking distance is a whole lot different than ours. Okay? I think a lot of the things we saw are because they're one generation removed from persecution. And they know that they may not have, that door's open. They don't know how long it'll be open. And they're gonna work. And they do. This individual here, if you saw the Commission Story magazine the IMB puts out this summer on Cuba, he's in this. We met several people that were in this. And when he was in elementary school when the revolution happened, his church was shut down, his pastor was put in prison. He was a Christian. And him and three of his friends were brought by their, I think it was about the fifth grade, in front of the class, and the teacher mocked them about being Christians. These are, you know, foolish people. They're Christians and all of that. He's the pastor of a church. They have a bus ministry. They go out. He's in a rural area, and they go out to the really rural areas and start churches. And that teacher is a pastor of one of the churches he started. So he baptized him. This is our eternal pastime. It's what we do. For those of you who don't know, in 99 is when we kind of officially kicked it off. We had used sports equipment at the high school, and I thought, man, if there's just some way to get this to missionaries that were doing sports evangelism. And those of you that have been in Hillcrest for a long time probably remember Brother Fred Bobie. And one of the things he said that always stuck with me, he said, you know, we're Baptist. We don't think God speaks to us in an audible voice. He talks louder than that. And I just remembered being in that storage room at the high school thinking someone ought to do something, and God said you. So we've done that. We've been able to send equipment to over 40 countries in that time. And for the last several years, we've hooked up with a group from Waco, Texas, and have been sending equipment to Cuba. So for about 5 or 6 years, we've sent a lot. And last spring, Mark and I took a van down to the Baptist Men's Warehouse in Dallas, and we were able to send enough equipment that they outfitted over 20 ball teams and also were able to do kids' clinics and things like that. And I was talking to the guy the other day, and they're going to try to bring some, they didn't take it all. They're going to take some more this fall. The convention there in Cuba They said, you know, sports are the way to go. They're baseball crazy. It is. They're, you know, soccer is number two, but it's a long way off. Baseball is number one in Cuba. And they said, we can get people to, you know, we can use it for evangelism. And they started an adult baseball league. And churches sponsor them. There's 20 churches that are sponsored by there's 20 churches that are sponsored by Baptist churches, and there are some churches that are other denominations. But anyway, they've been able to run leagues, and I always thought of it, you know, like church league softball, which can be kind of loose. You don't know who's going to show up and all of this. They kept stats. They had an MVP. It was serious baseball to them. And they were able to use it to evangelize at the different things. So we did bring a lot of equipment this time. We ended up, there were seven of us that went in, six on our team and someone who went to another church. And we wrangled, I think we ended up with a count of 39 check bags through the airport there in Miami. Customs was interesting. A couple of hours to get through. We're the last people. They shut and locked the doors after us because the airport was closed. But they also knew the guy we were with. L.M. Dyson is his name. And, the last time they came through, they had a 300-pound metal plow broken up into three or four bags. And they brought it through customs in Cuba. So they're kind of used to him bringing a lot of stuff. And they're not happy about it, but they let us through. So that's what mattered. Okay. This is the Christian League. This is their logo. And this is the Blue Angels, which is New Jerusalem Baptist Church in Havana. And I don't know how well you can see it. They're wearing Post 642. Those are from Sedalia. And it wasn't unusual to see a shirt with Sedalia across it or some other area. So anyway, and all the pants and things like that were probably from high school coaches that have donated. So why don't you boys hop up and we can start talking.
You can click through there. Just the right.
Yep.
Okay. This is... Well, Alex is a guy that runs a Christian league, and he actually invited us to come to practice with him, and is with his serious church team. And when you say serious, I know Dad talked about that a little bit, but this is not holding your back at the end and things like that. That's not like that. They were very for real. You know, they asked if I wanted to get up there because they knew I was a coach, and I'm not that far removed from actually playing. And so I get up there, and apparently it was batting practice. And, well, I didn't come all that way as an American to just throw batting practice, okay? So I'm not going to throw soft. I want to throw hard. And they're trying to tell me, oh, slow it down, whatever. So they punished me and kept me up there for about 80 pitches or so. And I don't know if you can see in here, but I look pretty wore out over there on the right. But anyway, it was good. But they were really interested to see that, these people were here for, they knew all this stuff had come from us, and that these were actually the people that were here, And you think about, one of the things that hit me when we go to visit this team was, the lack of, you have all these adults there, and I've got a son and another one coming, and I have not been out of baseball that long, but these guys have always stayed, and they have families, and they have jobs, and the one guy was, 44 years old, and he was just a kid. He was still playing, and he was still really good. And the inability of them to be able to get things, which we'll get to eventually, they just can't get things. That's not stores. I had packed in a bag of sunflower seeds, which is a staple for baseball, And they did not know how to eat them. They had never seen them before. I think they knew what they were, but they just, you just throw the whole wad in there. You don't think about it, And they just one at a time, and it kind of hits you like they just don't have the ability to even get something like this, And that was a comical part of it, but there was just so many things as we go along here that they just can't get a hold of. And so this picture actually was after that. They after every practice, they get together and they have a devotion time. And I had spoke a little and Dad spoke a little at this. And so it's very directed. You know, they share the gospel every time in all of these teams, you know, all over in these 20 different churches.
He said on the way to practice that day, they obviously are dressed as baseball players and they have their equipment, that, you know, people will talk to them, you know, because they want to know, are you, like, playing for the in the National League there in Cuba? And he said they were able to lead three people to the Lord on the way to practice that day. And that happens all the time, that they, you know, it just opens the door where they get to talk to folks.
This is actually the last night we were there. We had, as all the planning is going on, I'm a planner, and I'm thinking about how much time I'm going to be away from my family and things like that. And the time began to be extended and extended. It was like 8 days, then it was 12 days and 13 days. And actually, you know, God works those things where there's a purpose for that. And this was the very last night. This would have been 2 days after we would have left. And this is the Christian Baseball League's awards night. And this is at kind of the flagship church there in Havana. It's right by the seminary. And so they also had a volleyball league, mostly as the baseball players. And this is where they gave out their MVP and all this stuff. Of course, we were talking through an interpreter, which is sitting there by Corey, the older fella, and his name was actually Caesar Augustus, which he joked about that too, that it was the only Baptist church that had ever baptized a Roman emperor. So, but anyway, he had an incredible story himself, but he actually spoke English with a Chicago accent. So he had been there as a child before. But as it says up there, it says 25 players from the league recognized for the decision to follow Christ. They had done all these things, brought up their hitting MVP and their pitcher MVP and all this stuff. And then they bring up a bunch of the guys that had already been up there. And they said, this is the most important thing. And these were all the guys that had accepted Christ through that league that year. And, you know, it was just amazing to see. And I said this, and I kind of gave this at Birch Tree at my church, and I say, you know, the hardest demographic to reach is young men, especially, you know, about 20 to 30. And that was the only people that were standing there, you know, and I had never seen that in my life, let alone more than one, but 25 young men up there that had accepted Christ.
Alex talked to me and he said, you know, when we go do a ball game, we go around town and we invite people and we hand out tracts, which is legal for them. We're not Cubans, so we couldn't do that. But if they had a ball game, they would do that. And then they would have an evangelistic thing at the ball game. The 25 are just the baseball players in the league who got saved. Who knows how many people got saved at the ball games. And, you know, they played a full season and a series at the end and everything else. So, is really Alex is a go-getter. I mean, he is really fired up about this. And the only thing keeping him from doing more is having more to do it with. And that's what they want to do. But it's unbelievable the way God has used this.
This is the MVP of that year. They talked about all these different things. But when he gave his MVP speech, he said, the most important thing, all this really doesn't matter, the most important thing that happened to me this year is me accepting Christ. And so that was, with all this being serious, he thought this was the most important thing that anybody could make with their decision. And he got, like, a glove that we had sent down earlier, a new glove, and some of the people in there got jerseys, they had, like, a raffle and stuff. So it was cool to see how they were living it out and how our resources were being used in that.
Now, we got to meet with these guys. There was no problem giving them stuff or anything like that. There was a little concern. It was funny. One of the guys from the convention said, now, you know, if you're going to give them things, you know, he wanted us to be careful about it, you know, because the government's pretty sensitive about Americans coming in and showing what a failure their system is by having us give the stuff away. And so I told the interpreter, I said, well, just tell them all I was going to do is ask who wants to go play baseball in America, raise their hand. And so he was laughing, and he told our driver that, who didn't understand me because he didn't speak English. And he started laughing, and he raised his hands and told the interpreter to tell me that his wife and daughters can play ball, and they're ready to go. So I asked him if his wife could pitch, and he said she could learn. Now, one of the really cool things, I'll let the guys talk about this, is we got to meet some of the players in the Cuban National League. Now, the big team, the New York Yankees of Cuba, are the Industriales, which is the team in Havana. And, you know, you think of the barriers between us and a major league player. You know, you could just walk down to, you know, Busch Stadium and walk in and start meeting players and stuff. But the night we got there, and we're there late, and it's hot, and we've got all these bags of equipment, two of the guys that have volunteered to show up to move our bags and to load and unload the trucks are Major League Baseball players that have become Christians. And they met it off the boys, and we were able to give them some stuff there at the church. But they wanted us to go to practice with the Industriales, which is, you know, this big team. So we got to go down there. Now, that's the stuff you can't put on the internet, you know, those pictures and those things, because the government's really sensitive about, you know, those are the guys who would be, you know, the ones we dealt with, the older guys wouldn't. But, I mean, that's who, when you read about a player defecting, that's the league they're coming from. And the guys that were playing in the church league were good, and these guys were exceptionally good. You want to talk about them a little bit?
Yeah.
Maybe tell about Carrera.
The first two guys, they actually, I didn't know how old they were till later, but they actually, both of them were older than I was, which kind of made me feel bad. But they, anyway, they really did want us to go to practice with them. They were out of season. They played during the winter, and they're younger. It's kind of like a farm system. They have a younger team that's the Industriales, and they're kind of training them up to play. But they took us to one of the parks that they train at and wanted to hit with us and throw with us. And I think part of it was they're trying to size us up a little bit. And, you know, I was not in my best baseball shape, but I wasn't gonna back down any. And, but, you know, they got us in the cage and we hit and we threw with them, things like that. And it was good. But one of the guys that came down while we were there practicing with them was a guy by the name of Carrera. And a couple of years ago, if you have your finger on the pulse of sports or anything, and I really don't, but I remember this, that on SportsCenter and kind of national sports news, there was a Cuban player that made the news, only for the fact that he took a pitch high and tight, backed up, and then chased the pitcher down with a bat trying to kill him. And almost does. He just misses the guy's head barely, and there's a huge fight. Well, anyway, he got a suspension, 6 months. You know, he had this reputation of being a really horrible guy and just a mean guy. Nobody wanted to talk to him. You know, everybody knew this, had this really a bad guy reputation. And over his 6 month suspension, he became a Christian. And he came back, of course, in the league, and he began wearing the Cuba for Christ sticker on his helmet. And as superstitious as baseball people are, everyone did that because he was the best hitter in the Cuban league. Okay. Yeah, and he led him in home runs this past year. And anyway, just completely changed, and even news broadcasters noticed, things like that. And so they would interview him and ask him what had changed, and he would say, I'm a new man because of Jesus Christ. And, you know, he had that, you know, that story that he could share. And we didn't really think we were going to meet him, and he just shows up at this place. And I didn't recognize him from Adam, you know, but turns out this is who this guy was. And so the guys that we're with, that we were practicing with, of course, they kind of looked up to him. He's the best player in the Cuban league and whatever, and they talked to him, and they already kind of knew each other. But he gets in there and starts taking some cuts, and he was the best, yeah. But, you know, he had asked me a little bit about hitting, about this kid had come in and hit, and asked me, knew I was a coach, and asked about what his flaws were and things, and I felt impressed with myself that I was talking with him about that. But, you know, he was completely changed. And we went and looked that video up when we got back to internet and civilization. And, you know, it was the same guy. And it was unbelievable to see a change in that guy from that to what we had seen, you know.
He'd have caught him. It wouldn't have been good.
No, it would have been bad.
And then they went and had lunch with us. They went to the house we were at and just, you know, and they were. You could really tell that they were just, he was a happy man. And the impact, because in you have probably Fidel, who's the most famous person on the island, and then it's the baseball players. And here you have one of the best players, live television, giving his testimony, and there isn't anything the government can do about it because it's live and everyone's watching it. And it's, you know, I was told by, we sent a ton of helmets, and I was told by Dyson, the guy in Texas, he said, if you ever see the Industrialities, he said, all those helmets you sent down there, the national team's wearing them. They painted them blue and they're wearing your helmets. So that's our thing. So that's kind of a cool deal. But anyway, it allows, not us, because we can't, but allows that church that we work with to have a foot in the door and meet these guys and build a relationship with them. And, you know, several of them are Christians. And it's pretty exciting stuff. Well, we'd been a couple of nights and we'd brought a lot of shoes down. I'd shared that we got all these shoes for $3 at Walmart, and you know, we'd given some to the Industrialities, if you can imagine, whoever led the league in home runs last year, getting excited over a $3 pair of rubber cleats from Walmart.
Yeah.
And they were thrilled. Yeah. Okay. I counted it. We did an inventory because we were kind of planning on where we're going and everything else. And I was down to 56 shoes. Havana's a town of 9 million people. And I'm thinking, God, what's 56 shoes going to do? And I got this picture the other day. It got emailed to me because we gave them the shoes and everything. Some were given away. Some they've taken with them, and they'll go to things and they'll do stuff. And it brings kids in, and, you know, God blesses and multiplies beyond anything we can ever expect.
Talk about. Yeah. This is Luis. It's actually a guy that Dad has spent a lot of time with the first time that he was there. And he helps with some of the stuff that we did, but he also does a kind of a soccer ministry with the colored soccer balls. And, you know, he explained it perfectly in saying, you know, sports is the hook. You know, we talk about, you know, the culture that's there. You know, there's this ceiling. They can't go anywhere. So the only thing that they've got is this sports, and especially in baseball. And he does soccer too, but he said that's how they get that. You know, the gospel out there is to be able to hook these people with soccer or baseball, and then be able to present that gospel. And might not be able to see that, but he's holding that power band with the different colors on it, the plan of salvation, which is like the soccer balls too. You know, you had met him at,
the first time,
yeah, and done some vacation Bible school stuff with him, but, and we had seen him again this time, but.
You know those people that email all the time? That's Luis. He emails all the time. If I don't email him back that day, it's like, I haven't heard from you forever, my brother. Is everything okay? But Luis is great. I mean, I was really convicted. We were at in a town, and there was a drunk. It was middle of the afternoon, laying out on the street. And people were stepping over him and stuff like that. And we'd got him a bottle of water, and they were fixing him a sandwich and stuff. And, you know, judgmental. You know, man, middle of the day, it's noon, and this guy is passed out in the sunshine on the ground on a slab of concrete. That's so sad. And, you know, Luis he is so on fire for God and just does so much and in his church and everything else. And Brother Dyson came out of the little store that was right there and looked at him. He looked at me and he said, a couple of years ago, that was Luis Manuel. So God changes people.
Now, some of the next stuff here comes kind of the Cuban life part, and you kind of imagine, if you can imagine a city or even like a place like Lebanon and go without maintenance, buildings without maintenance, roads without maintenance, or just stopped in the middle of maintenance for 50 years, that's what all of Cuba looks like. So, it just had run out. Now this is a picture here is, now I teach and coach at West Plains. Of course, we're the Zizzers and the only Zizzers on earth, but not anymore. Okay. And you know, we had done the same thing. You know, I had talked to our head coach there at West Plains, and we had just this unbelievable amount of stuff. And I had been collecting some things when I was in college and from different college coaches and things like that. And then I get to West Plains, and we have, you know, I actually have the ability because I work there to add these things up. And so, we had got some stuff up here to Dad and whatever, and we had sent some sets of West Plains Zizzer stuff, and this is two of the guys that were part of the church, which we'll get to in a minute with the chicken farm, but they're wearing their Zizzer shirts here, West Plains stuff. And this is a
Luis's son's kids team that has equipment we sent.
Yeah. All right, now you go down, we would take the van out of town and go to different places in certain times, and they have these, you know, at one time were probably really good highways. There are four lanes on each side, but there's grass growing into the third lane, so you can, it's just no maintenance, like I said, but, you know, and they have the ability, the Soviets had built these for them, most of them. I mean, shrubs down the middle of the highway, street lamps, all kinds of stuff for miles and miles and miles, but they have all this, but there's nobody driving on them except us and maybe one or two other cars and whatever else. But most people did what's pictured here, is they would have some sort of dump truck or large truck of some kind, and these people would wait under overpasses and hold money out and whatever else, and they would all jump in the back of these cars and drive places. So most of the time there'd be 50, 60 people hanging off that truck there or more. But.
And, you know, we would think, well, it's probably day laborers, stuff like that. It might be a colonel in the Cuban Army. You know, I mean, there's just very little as far as, like, stuff.
Well, and they said, I know the missionary had told us that whenever they would go meet with the government, they had to go pick them up to go meet them. They just don't have the logistics to even drive their cars around, you know. You can't even imagine that here in the United States. They just would spend an inordinate amount of money to equip their people, but not there. Not the same thing.
Around like here, a lot of the old cars, like there's brands you wouldn't see a good old Ford down there or anything. It was all foreign cars, Soviet cars, and they. This is the one we took this one in a taxi, kinda, and we were taking this one, and they were, I mean, the worst shape. You think they're? I don't know. I mean, the lady that made a lot of her meals, she had two doctorates. She was professor at a college, and she drove the cruddiest car you've ever seen. And, you know, around here, she's driving a Mercedes around, and she, I mean, it was just the baseball players didn't have cars. We'd have to go pick up Major League Baseball players up. And so with these, you know, you're lucky if the back opened up or whatever. So it was quite the deal, and looking at all of them.
Well, you can imagine that, just like anything else, no maintenance. There's no parts. You know, Soviets aren't there anymore, nor American cars. There's no parts. So all these things are jimmy-rigged together, duct taped and fence and wire and all that. Everything's hugging them together. And so that's why none of them are in very good shape at all, like this one.
Of course, they do have the old cars, old American cars, and go ahead and click it and it'll get rid of that. But, you know, and so they try to keep them in good shape. Mark said he wished he had the Bondo concession down there. But that might have a Czechoslovakian motor in it, or, you know, some sort of transmission from the third world somewhere. You never know. But you, like you said, they're on an 8-lane highway, and there's hardly any cars on it, and they're going slow. And, I mean, it's just... Now, they did say every once in a while, they used to, you don't need more so much because it's all grown up. You'd see big metal pipes on the side of the road with spikes in them, because when the United States was going to land our jets on their highway, they were going to pull those out, so we couldn't do it. And I said, well, we didn't get the memo we were going to land jets, but anyway, they thought we were.
This is, as you can imagine, that, you know, power company here, you say everything's, power just doesn't click off very much, even in a thunderstorm, okay? But if the thunder hits within 100 miles, felt like the power went out down there. And you can see why. This is above one of the houses that we stayed at. This is about 3 feet from your head, and probably not this, everybody just tied into the line, okay? And so if power went out somewhere, it took a while to come back on. And we were there 2 weeks and it went off probably three or four times, I think, for 3 or 4 or 5 hours at a time. So,
this is one of the commodities of living there. And the main house we stayed at had a offset hot water, but no one was dumb enough to take a hot shower in the heat, but it was, this is a hot water head that it, you, there's, you see the breaker, and then you see these little wires come up, and when you turn it on, it, it might spark a couple times, and you got hot water out of her. So we thought that hot water was a good enough sacrifice to make it out of there all right. So we'd flip it, flip the switch off, and one of the times when the power went out, we were up on top of the roof because that's where everybody hung out because it was cool. And our lady was like, we were about to take a shower, and our lady was like, well, you won't have hot water. We're like, I think that's all right. We haven't had it for a while.
You can stay, people to make money will rent out their house. It's called a casa particular, and you have to have hot water in the shower, and you have to have air conditioning where they sleep. And this is the hot water. And, you know, though we preferred staying in those than the hotel, we didn't stay in a hotel at all this time, but we preferred staying in those because, you know, you're staying with people then, and you get to visit with them and stuff. And, you know, it's just better in building relationships. But, yeah, the we weren't big fans of hot water down there.
Well, and they, you know, economically, they the government allows them to do that, but then they charge them so much, whether they rent it out or not and whatever, so the ability to make money is still almost zero, you know, no matter how many times they rent it out. And that's with a lot of things, but especially that's something we saw every day was with them.
They believe in income equality. Keep everybody that's not a member of the Communist Party poor. And that's really what they do.
This is being a born in, or not born into, but married into farming, and see that, you know, we driving old tractors and things like that, but then you see this and you're like really proud of what you have. They're still plowing with oxen. Most people are. 99% of people are. And this was at one of the farms that was actually kind of, financially helped by one of the churches there. This was in, whatever the M place was. Yeah, outside of Santa Clara is where this was. And the guy that had kind of run the farm was not a, he was probably 30 years old, and they lived in a little one room, block shack. Yeah, that was about it. And, that's what he did. And this is where the plow went. They brought the plow to this guy here. But he had the deal. Of course, I can't really own property, but he had a 30 year lease from the government. And it's not like this place was already bottom land and things like that. It was completely brush, and they don't have bush hogs or anything. It took him and two other guys, I think it was like 3 months, right, with machetes to clear about, it was probably about, he had about 40 acres open, 3 months worth with machetes, and this is him plowing after that. So I can't imagine putting that much work into it. But anyway, it's like they're still stuck, you know, pre any of those other things. They're stuck back, you know, 1890s or something.
If you saw a commercial on television, I saw one on TV, and they had three plows, all of them offset, government, you know, this is Cuba's agriculture, but you never saw that. You saw this when you looked out the window of the bus. This, you know.
Yeah. This is at where the La Palma, where the scissor jerseys went with those guys, but this is, you know, they have this, they have certain rations they can have, and then they kind of are beyond that, don't have a lot of resources to do anything else. But this pastor had come up with a way to go from egg to chicken, and he had every stage along the way. And he did that, one, for his family, but I think he helped, one of the guys had mentioned that he did that with the church as well, kind of help people, and he did. He had the incubation, he had taken something out of a car to help be regulate temperature. And so, of course, if you've ever raised chicks before, it has to be a certain temperature, and if it got too high, it'd click off and all this. And he had, of course, jimmy-rigged all this on his own. Okay, he couldn't buy anything from Cacolatry or anything. And this was, he had hundreds of these, and then he had all the way stages out until in the yard, and then he had lots of hens. And I told Corey, I said, you don't see very many roosters out here, right? And so that's because they're eating them. But
he said this was not his passion. He didn't go in the ministry to raise chickens. But it helps his church, it helps people, so that's what he does.
Can you talk about that, Corey?
Yeah. The first couple days, they were really planning out and figuring out all these places they're going to go, and they were talking about all the soup and stuff they had. Well, we go to this place, and it was a warehouse made out of two containers, and there was big old barrels in there, and it was just full of soup mix. And far as you could see, I mean, it was a lot of more than I'd ever eaten in my life. It was, we'd pack her all up and we put it in the back of the van, and there'd be rice stuff with protein, and you throw that in, and every place we'd go, we'd stack up a whole load of that, put it in each family, each house, camp and everything. We'd unload it. Or I don't know how many pounds we actually distributed the whole time.
One of the big things we went into town, and we were able to go to the Diplomat store, which sounds a lot nicer than it was. It was like a dollar store on a bad day. A lot of empty shelves, but we got evaporated milk and cooking oil, and then we'd pick up this stuff. We'd go to the local pastors, and we'd bring them that. We also brought them coffee. They get from the government, they get free coffee, but it'll be half coffee and maybe shredded chickpeas or something like that mixed in as filler. So they don't like their coffee. So we actually brought them Cuban coffee from Florida. There's some Cubans in Florida that bring coffee in from Colombia, roast it the way Cubans like it, package it, sell the Cuban committee in Florida, community there. And so we brought in 50 pounds of that and would give it to these local pastors. And they were just so excited because it was coffee that was fit to drink, though I don't like coffee, so I can tell the difference between the good or the bad. But we did try it, and it doesn't matter if it's 110 degrees and you just ate a big meal, coffee. Okay, Vonda would love it. But, you know.
They, the missionary kind of warned us going to this Diplomat store. You know, this is kind of the store that they're showing off with, okay? And like I said, it's not the best thing, but as you kind of step into the store here, you know, like the meat department, and you think about packaged things here in the United States, the first thing that I see when you get to the meat department is a grocery cart full of chicken parts, not in packages, but in the cart, just piled in there. And that people are coming by and taking that out and putting it in their bags and things like that. And this is the thing that they're showing off with, you know, it's near a lot of the embassy stuff. And this is not good, okay? Not at all. And that missionary had said one time they were there and the whole store was completely empty except two rows of completely full of Vietnamese toilet paper, and that's all they had, okay, in the entire store. So not, and you imagine, like I said earlier, they just don't have the ability to go and buy things that they need. And this is the best store in the country, and chicken parts in it.
The government, of course, blames everything on the embargo, the trade embargo with the United States. But as, you know, the guy talked about, we're in a global economy. You know, Europe, there's plenty of companies, and even South Latin America that could supply Cuba, but they don't want to do business with the government because the government doesn't want anyone to make any money, and that's why businesses exist. And they're trying to, you know, take all their money and then tell them they have to hire so many, take their labor cost away from them, so you have to hire so many, and then they change the rules. And so the consensus, he said, even among the government officials he talked to, is the absolute worst thing that could happen to Cuba would be for America to drop the embargo, because then the excuse that they give to the Cuban people all the time would be gone, and it would, you know, just kind of expose the truth, which is the system doesn't work. This is the Calvary Baptist Church in Havana. We went there the first morning, and for the WMU people, the WMU was founded, and this was the first project, was to pay off the note on this church. And that was 100 and however many years the WMU celebrated this last time around. So it's kind of neat to be in there, and it's a pretty neat building.
Yeah, and it's an old French circus, so it had really, you know, French-looking architecture, high windows and things like that. But across the street from this is one of, you know, we got there in the dark and whatever, but the first thing you wake up to, you look out the window, is this scaffolding that's about four stories high. And there's trees growing from the street all the way up to the top of the scaffolding, okay? They'd done nothing, and I don't know how long the trees have been there, but that was everywhere. You know, it just stopped. There wasn't anything else.
One of the big things the Texas group has done over the years is water purification system. The government says everyone has water to drink in Cuba. That's true. You just don't want to drink it. And a lot of places in more than one town, really the only place to get a good drink of water that won't make you sick is at church, which is, you know, you start just thinking of living water and drinkable water, you know, and church is the only place to get both, you know. So this is one of the projects that the Texas group did is they had built a lean-to next to a church so they could have outdoor stuff. And they had asked about maybe leveling off this piece of ground behind the church so that they could, like, have an area to play in and stuff. And the thing about Brother Dyson is he's a harder charger than Alex, you know. And that went to, hey, let's put a concrete slab in. Let's give you a sport court. Well, that's hard to do in Cuba to get the concrete and everything else. And, you know, we were there the morning they dedicated it. And we were there, and they had the guy who did the work on it and everything. And they asked Brother Dyson to say a few words, and he really bragged on the guy who did the work. And I thought, wow, you know, he's really, of course, the guy did the work, so everything. We're leaving. It's been a good day, and we're in the car leaving. And that's when we get to hear that they thought we knew the story. We didn't. And they tell the rest of the story. They had put a water purification system in at the pastor's house. And he said, the water in this town is really, really bad. And so people would come to the pastor's house to get water. There's a little lean-to. It's outside. And there's a hose that goes out to the street. Got a little hole in the wall. And the hose comes out. And they'd come by and ask him to fill it up. And they would. And the church is just up the street a little bit. But across the street, a really little building, was a bar. And the guy who owned it didn't like the fact that, you know, the church is really gaining in popularity because people can get water from the pastor and it's bad for business. And so there was a man there by the name of Roberto that lived in that town who at age 14 was sent to prison for murder. And they kind of looked, did he do it? He said, you know, around here, who knows? But when he got out of prison 34 years later, he was a hard man. I can't imagine what 34 years in a Cuban prison would be. And he owed money from his bar bill to the guy who owned the saloon. And so the guy who owned the saloon hired him to work off his debt by running the preacher out of town. And so it was the preacher and his wife, and they had two little kids, probably not both of them under the age of 6 or 7. And so they would harass them. They would play loud music. They would they'd be drunk and out in the street, you know, at night, threatening the preacher, trying to get him to come out in the street and fight. Men would come over and urinate on the house while the kids are there. And the kid, they said they just cried themselves to sleep for months. And they got a hold of the liaison that works with the government a lot from the convention, who actually spoke at our Southern Baptist Convention just a week before we got there. And he went to the government and talked about it, and the government said, well, that's too close to a church, so we'll just close the bar down. And that's what they did. They closed it down. Well, it became a grocery store. It's back to being a bar again, and they're nervous about that. But meanwhile, this guy Roberto, who had been harassing the pastor, really began to feel bad about it. And he asked one of the ladies that he knew, kind of, that he knew went to that church, to tell the pastor he was sorry, kind of why he did it, and that he was sorry. And the pastor said, well, you know, we have to forgive, so I forgave him. But, you know, I couldn't forgive him. You know, he hurt, well, just me, but he hurt my children, traumatized them. And one night the man came by the house. He'd been drinking a little bit, but he wasn't drunk. And he began to talk to the preacher because he wanted to apologize in person. And while that was going on, he said, the man broke down and he began to cry. And he began to tell the pastor, you know, all the horrible stuff that had happened to him in prison. And just begging the preacher to be able to forgive him and everything else. And so the pastor said, you know, I'm crying with him. This man's caused me to cry a lot, but I've never cried with him, and I was able to forgive him because I didn't see him as the man who hurt me, but a man who had really been hurt. And they had a big breakthrough. Well, when they decide to do that, turns out Roberto, the guy who'd committed murder and harassed the pastor, his skill set is a mason. And so the pastor hired him to do the concrete work at the church, which kind of scandalized the church a little bit. It really did. It's a small town, and it really did in the community, because everyone in the community, you know, knew what this man had done. Everyone in church knew what he'd done. Now the preacher's hiring him to do the court, and probably the most shocked guy in the whole town, though, was Roberto. And it was such an opportunity when Roberto said, "Why did you do this?" So what's Jesus done for us? You know, we forgive. And not only that, Roberto couldn't support his family because though his skill set was as a mason, he didn't have any tools. And so the Texas group came in, they brought the tools, Roberto did the work on the court, and then they gave him the tools. So now he can support his family. And he was at church that morning, and that's why he made such a big deal of it, because he was giving his stamp of approval on Roberto for everyone in church to know, I stand with this man. Now he's not a Christian, so pray for Roberto, but he's close. I mean, he's still, go ahead and click it. This is, I didn't know what I was taking a picture of when I took it, but on the end is Roberto. The guy next to him is not Johnny Vaughn, that's the pastor. He does look like Johnny Vaughn. And they're hugging there after the service during the sport court dedication. And that's the kind of forgiveness that doesn't come with our ability. You know, I've thought about that. Could I forgive? You know, that comes with God's ability. And, you know, it's just an amazing story there of what God is doing in that community because of that pastor's faithfulness, because everyone's been witness to it. Amen. This is the map. It's one of my favorite things. It's really pretty. It's wood. But the ribbons coming off the island of Cuba over Caleb's shoulder there are going out. And I thought maybe it was mission teams that have come to Cuba the first time I saw it. And those are countries that Cuba has sent mission teams to. And, you know, my thought was, they got a lot of mission work right here in Cuba. And I'd expressed that the first time I was there, you know, that idea. And we say the same thing around here too, I know. And their response was, Acts 1:8 is for us too. You know, it's for all of us.
And you think about the resources, and that's kind of what, you know, pushed, you know, really hit me when I was there, was the resources for us are almost unlimited. You know, things are so easy for us. You know, you can get a meal in no time, and you can, your car, even if you have the worst car in the world, is better than anything they have, you know. And it's just so easy for us to come to church and do all those things. And for them, everything's so difficult. And maybe that's because persecution was not that long ago. But everything is so difficult, and they still do that. You know, as you're sitting there in church at the sport court dedication, and, you know, they're singing hymns that you know, but they're singing in Spanish, so all the English you know and all these hymns you've heard for your entire life is gone. And I hear this man behind me, I think it's a man, but it's like almost the most horrid sound I've ever heard. But he is just belting out this praise to God. You know, and I turn around and he's got like two teeth, and nobody would do that here, you know. But they have such a fervor to serve, you know, that it just doesn't matter. And maybe that's because it is difficult and things are too easy for us. So being that it's difficult actually means more, you know. And I think to them it's a purpose. You know, they don't have the distraction of making more money or getting a better whatever. They just can't do that. And so that fervor is there for everything. You know, when someone has a job to do in church, we just take somebody with a heart rate, you know. But them, they're just warding people off because everybody wants to serve, you know. And it just blew me away, because even at my church, which, you know, I'm related to most people there, but we don't have that many, and we do that, you know. And even at larger churches, it's even worse, but, you know, them saying that this applies to us too, and I think about the horrible, you know, chicken parts in a grocery cart. That's the best you have. And this applies to us too. And it was just unbelievable when I heard that, you know, Dad had told me that's what they had told him. And it's just almost, man, it makes you feel horrible because you just don't do enough, You know, and they told a story, I think, missionary told us a story about they had left a couple guys, I don't know if it's him or somebody else, and they were supposed to plant churches. And they came back a certain time later, and the men were in tears and apologizing, and they said, we could only plant 20-some churches in, I don't know how many days it was, like 4 months. And it was like, are you kidding me? You know, and they didn't have a car. They walked to all these places. And they did it, you know, it was like one every 3 days. And it makes you feel bad because they, you know, they have this fervor and they really follow what they're supposed to do. And it just gives you that fire inside to say, you know, I can be doing more than what I'm doing because I make this too easy. You know, every day you make it too easy. And you have to think about that too.
We can click the last one. You know, God's blessed and allowed us to go do some foreign missions in some different countries and everything else. And kind of what, backing up what Caleb's saying, the big difference, you know, we've been places where you're the missionary, you're here, you do everything, and we'll just watch, you know, and the church just sits back and you're supposed to do stuff. Cuba's not that way. They want to do everything. I mean, when they talk about we want to Cuba for Christ, we want to win our island, they mean every single person tomorrow is what they want to do. And they want to live, and they live that way. And they, all they want, give us the stuff to do it with. You know, if I could get a, you know, a semi truckload of equipment down there to, Alex, he'd start 2 or 3 more leagues tomorrow. You know, and he has a job, but that's his job. You know, this is his life. This is what he's going to do. And you do, you feel so guilty when you look at the fervor. And again, I think a lot of it is, you know, when you've been that close to the door being shut and suddenly it's open. And, I mean, they're, you know, just pray for the work there because it's going on like gangbusters. I get reports all the time and, you know, for me, one of the big things was we do such a little thing. We give sports equipment that people give out of their excess, you know, because they've replaced it with new. That look what God can do. And we just need to be faithful to keep doing what we can do, and he'll keep using it. So, do you guys have anything else? All right. Brother Dave.
I want you to take your Bibles and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And first of all, let me just say, relax. I've preached long enough that I understand that the mind can endure only what the seat can embrace. I just want to leave you with these verses tonight. And those of you that came to hear about Revelation, please come back. We're going to get into it. I've got a sermon I can't wait to preach, and you're going to hear it. You're going to hear about the final judgment and that part in chapter 20 that we were covering. But this was important tonight. You know, we've had a summer of mission opportunities at Hillcrest Baptist Church. It's been a summer of missions, and we've had a variety of experiences. We started out way back in May going to Angola to the prison in Louisiana, and then we've had people on mission in Senegal. We've had folks in Rockaway Beach. We've had folks in Cuba. We've had folks in Bolivia and folks in East St. Louis. And we've seen God at work in a lot of different situations. And we've been challenged, hopefully personally, about the mission work that we each are called to do in our lives. And so I want to read to you. This is a favorite passage of mine. This is a passage that takes place during Paul's third missionary journey. And he's writing this letter to the church at Corinth. And in verse 8, I want you to listen to what he says here. In chapter 16 and verse 8 of 1 Corinthians, he says, I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. You know, our life is made up of choices. We have opportunities each and every day. We have to make choices about where God would have us to serve. Sometimes our plans change, but rest assured, God has a mission. God has a plan for you right now, like we talked about today. Paul says to the church at Corinth, I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. Now look at verse 9. Because a wide door for effective ministry has opened for me. A wide door for effective ministry has opened for me. What is your wide door for effective ministry? Who would believe that God would use baseball equipment and sports ministry to open such a wide door of ministry in Cuba where many people are being saved? Who would imagine what's going on in Senegal, what's going on in Angola and Bolivia? And who would imagine the ministry that a bunch of country folks from Laclede County could do in East St. Louis, Illinois? Where is your wide door for effective ministry? Because God has a place for you. God has a place where you can serve, where there's a wide door. It may be right here. It may be a ministry that we're getting ready to embark on right here this fall. Maybe it's in Awana. Maybe it's with our students like we talked about this morning. But God has a wide door of effective ministry for you. But there's one more thing I want you to see in this passage. Paul says, I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost because a wide door for effective ministry has opened for me. But look at that last phrase. Yet many oppose me. Many oppose me. You know, wherever we go, wherever we see mission work being done, whether it's here or in other countries or other places of this country, there are always many who oppose me. The enemy does not like seeing light brought to darkness. The enemy doesn't like to see us penetrate the darkness. And folks, we just need to understand that wherever we go and whatever we do, the enemy is going to oppose us. He's going to oppose us right here when we build family life centers. We try to reach out to unchurched children and families. He's going to oppose us when we go on mission, maybe through a communist government or through some guy who's going to set up shop in a bar next to our church and cause us all kind of trouble. There will always be opposition. But greater is He who is in me than he who is in the world. We're so thankful for what Paul and the boys were able to experience and share tonight. And I just want to close with an invitation. I always want to close with an invitation. I want you to bow your heads and close your eyes. Stuart's going to come and lead us an invitation in just a moment. Let me just reiterate what we just read in the Scripture together. And let me just ask you, what is your wide door for effective ministry? Maybe there's something in your life that you have avoided. Maybe there's a place you need to be. Maybe the place is right here. Maybe there's someone here tonight that needs to come forward and make a decision. Join the church. Maybe there's someone that needs to be saved. Maybe God's speaking to your heart in some way. Would you just yield to Him? Would you just say yes to what His plan is for your life? You've known it for a long time. And tonight is the night. It's just been confirmed in your heart. You were here for a purpose. And you may not even have to tell me as pastor, but you need to say yes to God right now to whatever it is He's got for you to do. What is your wide door for effective ministry? It may require you to stay in some place where you don't want to stay or to go to some place you didn't necessarily want to go. But all of us have that wide door of effective ministry. And then secondly, tonight, will you pray for God to give you strength when the enemy opposes you? When he opposes you with other people? And remember that when people are in your path and they're in opposition to you, that that's ultimately a spiritual battle. Because Paul says, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities and rulers of dark forces of evil. Will you just recognize that there is opposition? Will you stand strong against it and continue to live your life boldly? Take some risks and see how God brings you through it. On the other side of it, you'll be amazed that God worked in the way He did. Our Father, we thank You so much for how You love us, for these stories, these testimonies that You have just reminded us and burned in our hearts of Your faithfulness and Your love and the fact that You're going to get the job done. Lord, one day there's going to be a multitude of people gathered around Your throne worshiping You. People from every tribe, every tongue, every nation, every people. People who have come to know Jesus as Lord and Savior. God, I just pray that we'd be mindful of that and we would live our lives in a way that counts for You. Making the most of every time and making the most of every opportunity. Making the most of our talents and the most of what we have to give. Thank You so much for Paul and Caleb and Corey and for their willingness to go and just for how You have worked through them. Just continue to bless the church in Cuba in a mighty way. I just love how they have a desire to go and to fulfill Acts 1:8. Lord, that is all of us. Every person, every church, every believer needs to be a part of the Acts 1:8 principle to go to Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Just speak to us now, Lord, and may Your will be done during this invitation. In Jesus' name, amen.